Well, hi, everybody. How is everyone? Do you need to stand up and stretch? Are you awake? I only have 50 pages of notes this morning. No, I'm kidding. nothing that overwhelming, I hope. Well, I'm so delighted to be able to be here and very honored to be asked to share today. And I'm going to be talking about two of the women of the Bible, two of the important mothers of nations, Sarai and Hagar. And as we look at this story, I have to make my disclaimers. So first of all, we remember that 70 faces has the Torah. It's a very famous rabbinic saying, 70 faces has the Torah. What does that mean? That means that Scripture is deep and rich and wide. And there are sometimes various ways that you can read a text. And today I want to read the story of Sarai and Hagar and Abraham as a personal story, looking at individuals. This is not a political sermon. This is not meant to be a political interpretation. What I want to look at is a family. It's a very complex family. It's a very contemporary family. It's a family in which there are wives and there are other women. There are parents as couples, and there are single parents. There are half-brothers. There are stepchildren. And all of these things, which happened so many thousands of years ago, speak to us as well today, because we live in a society of complicated families. And sometimes a person can be walking their walk with God, and they think, oh, you know, I know this Bible, I've read it so many times. What in it speaks to me? I'm in a situation that's so urban and so modern and so different than anything that the Bible talks about, you know, pastoral nomads, and here I am in a city with this complicated family situation. And yet the Bible has the same kinds of problems, and it addresses them in very real ways and in very honest ways. It talks about individuals who are struggling. These are individuals who struggle with a calling in God, people who want to serve Him. Some of them are brought into the world of God's kingdom or brought into serving God unwittingly due to circumstances beyond their control. Situations come upon them that they have no control over, and within that circumstance, they somehow have to find out who they are in God. So today, as we look at Sarai and Sarah, as she later becomes, and Hagar and Abraham, we're setting aside thoughts of politics and regional situations, and we're looking at human individuals who are trying to find a way to respond to the promise and the calling of God in their lives without doing too much damage to each other in the process, I should add. And I want to start at chapter 16. Which is the beginning of Hagar's story. And then we'll move from chapter 16 and we'll go back to Sarah and we'll go forward as well to the culmination of Hagar. The Lord willing, we'll do this in a time-efficient manner. So let's go to chapter 16 and use that as our launching pad. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abraham, "Now behold, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children through her." In the Hebrew it really says, "Perhaps I shall be built up through her." And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. And after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Abram's wife Sarai took Hagar the Egyptian, her maid, and gave her to her husband Abram as his wife. And he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was lower in her sight. She was made low in her sight. So Sarai hopes that through the relationship of Abram and Hagar, she will be built up. But in truth, the Hebrew tells us that what happens is that she's diminished in her sight. Our translations don't always hit on these little words, but they're important. And Sarai said to Abram, "May the wrong done me be upon you." It's all your fault. That's what it's like, typical. "I gave my maid into your arms, but when she saw that she had conceived, I was lowered in her esteem. May the Lord judge between you and me." And Abram said to Sarai, "Behold, your maid is in your power. She is in your hand," literally. "Do to her what is good in your sight." So Sarai treated her harshly, and she fled from her presence. This story, which is really a turning point in the story of Abraham and Sarah and Hagar, takes place 10 years after God had given Abraham a calling and a promise. That calling and that promise emerges in chapter 11 and chapter 12. At the end of chapter 11, we're introduced to Abraham and to his relatives. And the first thing we learn about Sarai, even back then, was that she was barren. And to be barren, of course, is a great tragedy in the wife of a patriarchal monarch, a nomadic shepherd. And it went against everything that God would speak to Abraham about his future. So in chapter 12, of course, God called Abram to go forth with his wife and all of his flocks to a land where he would make him a great nation. God promised that somehow this progeny, descendants, would come from a man whose wife was infertile. Abram took that word, he took that vision, he took that calling of God, and he went forth with it, and he focused on the fact that he had a promise from God, and that promise meant that he would one day have this wonderful, fulfilling life as patriarch and father of nations. And as they came down to Canaan, I don't know what Abram is thinking. The Bible doesn't tell us all of the things that go through in everyone's minds. We just see these hints, bits and pieces here and there. They come to Canaan, and a famine comes upon the land in chapter 12, verse 10. As this famine comes upon the land, Abraham decides to take action, and he goes down to Egypt. Throughout the stories of both Sarai and Hagar, we find the anticipation of the experience of Israel in Egypt. And much of the language that has to do with both of these women will also have to do in the future with the children of Abraham and their experience in Egypt. So the famine reminds us of the famine at the time of Joseph, of course. Going down to Egypt, where there is a perennial supply of wheat because the Nile River every year floods, and so you can count on good crops every year and you don't have to depend on rainfall. It's the breadbasket of the ancient world. They go down to Egypt to sojourn and to find refuge until the famine will pass. And the first thing that we find out about their stay in Egypt is that as they approach this country, Abram, who is from a Mesopotamian background, says to his wife Sarai, "Now I realize that you are a beautiful woman." We don't often think about what it meant to be beautiful in biblical times. But as we read the Bible, we find that for a woman to be beautiful is to be in a dangerous position. Beauty causes women in the early days of the Bible to be susceptible to capture or to abuse. We think about Bathsheba, who David looks upon and takes for his own. We think about the daughter of David, Tamar, who was abused by her half-brother. To be beautiful was a dangerous thing. And it's not until the late Old Testament period, to the late biblical period, that there are women like Esther and Judith in the Apocrypha who are able to use their beauty to accomplish things. But in the early days of the Bible, just as Abraham says here, "You're a beautiful woman and this could be dangerous for me." What is he afraid of? He's afraid that he will be killed. He says, "When the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me, but they will let you live. They will take you and make you part of the harem," is his understanding. So Abraham devises a strategy. He says, "Tell them that you are my sister, and then it will go well with me because of you. that I may live on account of you. What is his strategy? Abraham knows that he has a calling of God upon his life. God has called him to be the father of a great nation. So as Abram goes down to Egypt, he realizes that he has to protect the promise. In protecting the promise, he has to protect himself. So isn't this a smart idea? This is the right thing to do. He's well-meaning, but he says to Sarah, "Honey, if we don't protect me, you know, all of God's will could be thwarted." And so it's really important that when we go down to Egypt, we do this. If you could just cooperate with me in this thing, because realize, one way or another, you're going to go into the harem. Isn't that what he's sort of saying to her? Either pass yourself off as my sister and go into the harem, or they'll kill me and take you into the harem either way. So, face it, the better thing is for you to put yourself on the line and pass yourself off as my sister. And in that way, you can use this situation to protect the promise of God. Now, we are so familiar with this story that I think sometimes we don't understand how horrible it is for Sarah. How her husband says to her, "There are only two choices before us. You can go into the harem, say you're my sister and I will live, or you can go into the harem, say I'm your husband and they'll kill me." There's not a third choice that perhaps God somehow will do something else to protect his promise and to protect the calling on Abraham's life. Abraham, in his wisdom, can only say to her, "Honey, you're my only hope. Why don't you go become the concubine of the Pharaoh?" And that's what he's saying to her. We shouldn't pretend that it's anything else. He's rationalizing, for the sake of his calling, her being with another man. That's what the text is telling us. And that's what Pharaoh says to us when he rebukes Abraham later on. This is not an easy situation, and it's meant to shock us, and it's also meant for it to help us understand why the relationship between Abraham and Sarah can be so difficult at times, because he's really asking something very extraordinary. He may do it for all the right reasons, but it's still very hard. So, he gives her two choices. He says, "It's you for the will of God." And as he said, it was true. When they came to Egypt, the Egyptians indeed saw that she was very beautiful. And Pharaoh's officials saw her and praised her to Pharaoh. And the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. And he treated Abram well for her sake and gave him sheep and oxen and donkeys and male and female servants and female donkeys and camels. So not only had Abram given up his wife in order to protect himself and the promise, but also he receives tremendous wealth as a result. Almost like Israel going out of Egypt later, when they go in the Exodus, they'll take all the wealth of Egypt with him. But this thing is sort of snowballing and escalating to a point where Abraham is protected and enriched while Sarah is at risk in Pharaoh's household. What can happen in this situation? The bottom line is that when God gave Abram a promise that he would be the father of many nations, Abraham forgot to take into consideration one aspect of that promise. And that is that you cannot become a father without a mother. See, it's Mother's Day. Now we're connecting. How could Abram become the father of a nation without a mother? And that mother, in God's purposes, when he calls Abram, is meant to be Sarai. And Abram, although he realizes that he's received the promise and therefore is worthy of protection, is not actually giving full esteem to the role that his wife is to play in fulfilling that promise of God or in seeing it come to pass. And so as Sarai is put into this dangerous situation where she isn't being protected by Abram, God himself steps forward to protect her. And he smites the household of Pharaoh with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. In the situation where, for whatever reason, Abram did not make the choice of protecting her. God himself stepped in to vindicate this woman and to bring her to safety once again. Because in God's understanding of this promise, Sarai always had an important role to play. And so he judges Pharaoh's household, and Pharaoh calls to Abram and he says, "What have you done to me? Why did you not just tell me the truth that she was your wife?" Abram assumed that Pharaoh would not be an honorable man. And what Abram did was, in attempting to orchestrate the situation to protect himself, he never offered to Pharaoh the opportunity to choose rightly for the will of God as well. And so Pharaoh says to him, "Why did you do this to me? You didn't tell me the truth. You didn't give me the opportunity to act justly, and now judgment has come upon my house. Why did you say she is my sister so that I took her for my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go." Bye-bye. I don't want anything more to do with this. And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they escorted him away with his wife and all that belonged to him. We don't want to judge Abram too harshly, because we know we've all been in situations like this, where we look at a situation that seems so terrible and so threatening, and we act out of our own wisdom to try to make sure that whatever we see as the calling is going to happen. But we're just dealing with what the text says here. This is the history of Abram and Sarai. As they have come into a new country, Sarai has left everything to come with this man in fulfillment of what they see as a joint calling in their lives. And God wants her protected as well as him. And so when Abraham was not able to protect her, God himself stepped in. So the first lesson that we learn from Abraham and Sarah is, if God has called a husband, he's called a wife. It's a joint calling, and we need to esteem one another in love. We need to protect one another, and we need to not force a situation in which the other is put at risk for a calling. We need to allow God the room to create the protection and to find a way to work through this joint calling that we have. It's not about any of us singly as individuals. It's about mutuality, God working through a husband and a wife together in a calling like this. But that's part of their history. And when we come up to chapter 16, 10 years later, Sarah has waited. Sarah has experienced the divine protection of God. Sarah has received a confirmation from God that she is important and that she matters for this will of God. And yet 10 years have gone by and nothing has happened. Not a pregnancy, not a child. And in the beginning of chapter 16 there, as we come to Hagar's story, we begin to sense her frustration. What can she do? Maybe she has misunderstood how God's will come to pass in their lives. Maybe she hasn't gotten it right. Now, she's from Mesopotamia originally, from Ur of the Chaldees. And in Ur of the Chaldees, we actually know that they did practice surrogate parenthood. They had surrogate mothers already going back to 2000 BCE. We have the Code of Hammurabi that gives legislation governing such a situation. A situation very parallel to that of Abraham and Sarah. And we have other law codes from Nuzi that preserve the same information. So when we see this situation for the first time in the Bible, of a woman of status, like Sarai, taking her maid and giving them to her husband to bring up children for her own name, this is something that comes out of their cultural background. As we look at the text here in chapter 16 that we've just come back to, this is our first introduction to Hagar. And although the story tells us her name, we should notice, first of all, that Abraham and Sarah never say her name. She is part of their possessions. She is a maid that they own. But her name is never mentioned by them. They don't acknowledge that she is Hagar. They acknowledge that she is another way to try to get God's will to come about in their lives. And as they follow something that they know from their own cultural background, their own history, by giving this maid to Abram, she does indeed conceive. But something happens as we read Hagar's story that Abraham and Sarah did not count on. They didn't anticipate. While they have treated her as just part of the household possessions, not giving her personhood or status, in verse 4 it says, when she saw that she had conceived, then her mistress was lowered in her esteem. The story of Hagar is a story of seeing, and throughout her narrative, both here in chapter 16 and in chapter 21, the verbs of seeing will become very important. While Abraham and Sarah might have thought about Hagar as simply a means to an end, a way to accomplish the fulfillment of God's will, since 10 years have gone by and there seems to be no other hope for a woman who's both old and barren, for Hagar, this is a moment where she realizes that she does have value. She has value beyond simply being someone's slave. She has life-giving value. She is a pregnant woman. And that pregnancy is something that gives her worth, and it empowers her to know that she can bring life into a situation. In fact, as her own identity and self-worth and self-esteem start to grow, she feels perhaps competitive with Sarai. We don't know what Abraham's feelings toward Hagar are, but she certainly feels that she has a position now, she has a platform from which she could negotiate, and that her own personhood grows. She looks down upon Sarah, and Sarai blames Abraham. Now, we don't know if in her lament, when she says to Abram, may the wrong that was done to me come back to you, whether she's talking about the whole history, from the time that they left Ur of the Chaldees and started wandering the world, winding up finally in Egypt, putting her in the harem of Pharaoh, bringing her back to Canaan, and still no child, is it a pipe dream? I've done everything I can for you, Abraham, and now look where we are. This maid is competing with me, and she has no status. She doesn't realize that her only job is to just be a baby factory. This is your fault, Abram. We wouldn't be in this situation today if it weren't for you. This is her lament. The Lord judge between you and me, she says. And so Abram, who is quite silent and very passive in all of this, says, you are my wife. The maid is in your power. She belongs to you. You do what is good to her in your own eyes. And Sarah treated her harshly. In Hebrew, the verb is aneh. And it's the same word that we use for the affliction in Egypt. She was abusive to the pregnant slave, Hagar. Well, this experience of intensely growing animosity, as opposed to receiving mercy from Sarai, as Hagar is pregnant and going to have a child, which will become supposedly Sarai's baby, instead she receives even more severe treatment at the hand of Sarai. And Hagar has emerged enough in this situation that she's not going to take it anymore. She says, I am a person. And she fled from the presence of Sarai. She decided to run away. She was not going to live with a slave mentality anymore, she decides. She's going to run away from both Abram and Sarai. And she flees off into the wilderness. And then we come to the next section of the story, from verses 7 to 16. As Hagar runs into the wilderness, an angel of the Lord finds her by a spring of water on the way to Shur. And he said, Hagar, Sarai's maid, where have you come from and where are you going? And she said, I am fleeing from the presence of my mistress, Sarai. Then the angel said to her, return to your mistress and submit yourself to her authority. Moreover, the angel of the Lord said to her, I will greatly multiply your descendants, so that they too shall be too many to count. Now, as Sarai has fled into the wilderness, she goes towards Shur. And the wilderness of Shur is actually going to be one of the stopping points of the Israelites on their march on the Exodus. But whereas they didn't find water there, she finds water there. For a brief moment in the wilderness, having manifested her independence, she finds water and she's on a way to breaking free. She's the first person in the Bible to be met by the angel of the Lord or to receive a word from the angel of the Lord. The first person. And he calls her by name. He doesn't say, Sarah's maid. He says, Hagar. The angel of the Lord is the first person to say, I know your name. You are a person, a whole person. I see you. But he qualifies that and says, Sarai's maid, because she is not yet a free person. And this running away on her part is not a being set free yet. She hasn't been liberated. She hasn't been given sustenance or anything to help her build a new life. She is an escaped slave. And so he says to her three things. First of all, go back to your mistress and submit yourself to her authority. This is not an easy thing in a nation where, in Israelite legislation, runaway slaves are going to be set free. You're not supposed to have to return them to their masters. This is quite striking. Why is she told to go back when we know that the Levitical code will allow runaway slaves to be set free and protected? It seems a striking thing, but we have to remember she's a pregnant woman without any financial support, in a vulnerable position, and God is not finished yet with the child that she bears. He has a destiny for this child, and I think for the destiny to be fulfilled, she must return to the household of the father. So he says, go back and submit to her authority, literally to her hand. The second thing that he says to her is, I will multiply your descendants so they shall be too numerous to count. This is a promise given to her, not to Abraham. She's the first woman in the Bible to receive such a promise. This is the type of promise that's usually given to the patriarch of a line. But in this case, Hagar receives the promise directly from God that this child will be the father of a great nation. And then he says, your child will be a son. This is a third thing. Your child will be a son, and his name will be called Ishmael. The Lord will hear. The name is a prophetic name that is meant to be a description of what of one particular aspect of this child's life. He will be a child whom God will hear. And that word that she receives in the desert is a word that she needs to cling to for the future. Because the Lord has given heed to your affliction. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone. Everyone's hand will be against him. And he will live to the east of his brothers. This child will be like his parents, Abram and Hagar, strong people, people who are unafraid, people who are willing to go out and face the wilderness to pursue what they understand to be the vision. So he will be a strong man. In verse 13, we find one of the most remarkable things about Hagar. Then she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, El Roi. You are a God who sees me. The God who sees. And she said, have I remained alive here in this place after seeing him? She's the first person in the Bible to give God a name, to give a description to who the Lord is. And what she says is extremely personal. As we saw in verse 4, when she saw that she conceived, her own self-identity opened up, that she is someone beyond just a slave. God finds her in the wilderness and he names her name. And he says, you are Hagar and you are going to be the mother of a nation. And she finishes that experience by saying, the God who met me here is the God who sees me, who confirms that I am someone, that I have a place to play in this particular role, even though she was brought into it totally without any ability to choose, totally outside of her own will. So she called the name of the place Be'er Lahai Ro'i, the well of the living one who sees me. It is between Kadesh and Bered. And Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of his son, whom Hagar bore, Ishmael. And Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to him. Now, the interesting thing about this naming and the birth of the son is that when Hagar comes back, although she submits herself to the authority of Sarai, this child does not become the child of Sarai, because we see instead that Abram is the one who names the baby. And when we look at the parallels in Genesis with other women who have had their maids bear children, so we're looking at Rachel and Leah, and we're looking at Bilhah and Zilpah, the competition between the two sisters and the 12 children who are born, Leah and Rachel are the ones who name the children of Bilhah and Zilpah, because Bilhah and Zilpah are their property. And as a result, their children are the property of Rachel and Leah in a sense. They build up the house of Rachel and Leah, and Rachel and Leah name those children. But Sarai does not name the child of Hagar. God has chosen the name. Abram is the father, and Sarai really has no authority to call that child her own. This is not the child of promise for Sarai. Well, as we come to the next most important event, we come to the birth of Isaac. And in the story of the birth of Isaac, we come once again to the conflict and the competition between the two women. This would be the conclusion of Hagar's story. Along the way, Abram has been visited by the angel of the Lord once again when he was 99 years old. And the promise was given once again that Abram would be the father of a great nation. Three times God has given this word to Abram. And Abram and Sarah both laugh. Abram laughs in chapter 17 of Genesis. How can I in my old age have a child? And God is very gentle in his response and says, no, you will have a child. And Abram in chapter 17 says, well, why can't it be Ishmael? I have a son, and I love this child. He's a great kid. Why can't it be Ishmael? He could live before you, Lord, he says in chapter 17, verse 17. And God says, no. The calling came to you and your wife. Your wife is Sarah, and she is going to bear you a son, and his name will be called Isaac, and I will establish my relationship with him. In chapter 18, when Sarah hears the news that she will conceive, she laughs. But rather than having a soft and gentle answer from the Lord, she receives a rebuke. In chapter 18, verse 12, Sarah laughed to herself, saying, after I have become old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also? And the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh, saying, shall I bear a child? Is anything too difficult for the Lord? And Sarah denied it, and she said, well, I didn't laugh. Why does God judge Sarah for laughing, but he doesn't judge Abraham for laughing? Some of the Old Testament commentators would suggest it is because back in chapter 12, when Sarai went into the harem in Egypt, and God sent plagues on the household of Pharaoh, he manifested in a sovereign, miraculous way his protection of Sarah and her importance to the promise. She has already seen his miraculous intervention on her behalf. So why now does she laugh and think that he cannot once again act on her behalf? Abram did not experience that in the same way that Sarai did. And so Sarai should know better. She should know that what God has begun, he's going to finish with her. She is protected and called according to his promise. So we come back to chapter 21 and the last events with Hagar. In chapter 21, we have two scenes. We have the birth of Isaac and his weaning. And then we have, once again, the flight of Hagar as she leaves the place. As Isaac is born and weaned, we assume he's maybe 2 years old, anybody's guess, this would make Ishmael about 16 years old at this point. And the text says in verse 9, on the day of the feast, when Isaac was weaned, Sarah saw that the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, mocking. And what it says in the Hebrew is misahek. It's the same Hebrew root for the name Yitzhak. It's the word to play. We don't know exactly what it is that Ishmael is doing with the boy. We don't know if he's playing rough, if he's playing in a good way, if he's playing in a bad way. But something about the encounter between Ishmael and Isaac is threatening to Sarah. And whether she thinks that this child will exert too much influence on her son, whether she thinks that there will be complicated inheritance issues in the future, she has decided now that this is enough. Therefore, she says to Abraham, "Drive out this slave and her son, for the son of this slave shall not be an heir with my son Isaac." To play, the sahek, that's the verb in the text that belongs to Isaac, and that's his calling and that's his role. It's not Ishmael's. And so Sarah wants him gone, and when she talks about them, she doesn't even call them by name still. We see that there is something in her heart that is threatened and unhealed in this situation, so she cannot call her Hagar. She cannot call the child Ishmael. It's the slave and her son. Not only that, but she does not even say to Abraham, "your son," because he is also Abram's son. Rather, it is the son of the slave, it is her son. And her language is a very distancing language. It shows us clearly that there's a strong need for her to protect this household from what she sees as an encroachment and a threat. But for Abraham's credit, we have to notice in verse 11, that the matter distressed him. It was grievous in his sight. In the Hebrew, it's ra'ah. It was evil in his sight. He loves Ishmael. He wants to protect this child. But for the sake of the peace of his home, the two cannot live together. He turns to God, and God says, "Do not be grieved because of the lad and your slave. Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her. For through Isaac your descendants shall be named. But the son of the maid I will make a nation also, because he is your descendant." Despite the fragileness of this family, and I think Sarah is a very fragile but strong person. She's strong in exerting her authority, but she's fragile in her security. And despite all of the complexity, God says, "I still have a calling on that child's life. Ishmael will be a great nation. I will not abandon my promise to you or to his mother, that he will become a significant people." So Abram arose in the morning, took bread and a skin of water, which to me personally does not sound like very much if you're going to send somebody out into the wilderness, but I have no explanation why he doesn't give her more. But he now has set them free. And this time, when Hagar goes out into the wilderness, she goes out a free woman, no longer a runaway slave. However, she still lacks a financial basis or an economic basis on which to build a life. They head out into the wilderness of Beersheba. And it's hot. And the water is drunk up. And she has now come to the very end of her experience. Who is this God of Abraham, this God of this Hebrew man, who allows her to experience such abuse, who allows her to be so alone and so forlorn, who allows her to suffer at the hand of a mistress who does not like her or esteem her? This is the experience that she has had in being a slave in this household. As she leaves the boy under an acacia tree, and she goes away, about a bow shot away, because she cannot stand to listen to the death of her child. She doesn't want to hear him cry, and she doesn't want to see him die. But all of her own resources are now exhausted. There's nowhere else for her to go and no one to turn to. And she sits down and she says in her heart, "Do not let me see the boy die." And lifting up her voice, she weeps. And God heard the lad crying. And the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said, "What is the matter with you, Hagar? Don't be afraid, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad and hold him by the hand. I will make a great nation out of him." And God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. And she went and filled the skin with water and gave the lad a drink. And God was with the lad, and he grew, and he lived in the wilderness and became an archer. And he lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother found a wife for him from the land of Egypt. Hagar is a woman who suffered a lot at the hands of a vision and a calling of Abraham and Sarah. But God knew Hagar by name throughout every part of her life, in the household and on the run. And God did not let her be destroyed by Abraham and Sarah's calling and by their fumbling attempts to try to fulfill his will. Instead, he knew her by name, and he watched out for her. And he promised that out of what could be great death, he would bring great life, and he would bring a nation. And when she came to that place of utter despair and hopelessness in the wilderness, he said, "It's not just you that I see, Hagar, but it's the child that I hear. For your sake, but for the sake of the child, for the sake of my promise, for the sake of my word, I won't let him die here." And then, in the midst of her desert death experience, he opened her eyes to see a provision that was already there. The well was there all the time. The water was there all the time. But it took God once again opening her eyes to see the well and the water and the provision in a place of utter desolation. And so I take great strength from that story, from all of these stories. God cared about Abram. He had a calling on his life. Whatever our callings in life are, whatever our visions are in life are, we share them with our families. He wants us to esteem each other as we serve him, to esteem husbands and wives, to esteem children. He wants us to be gentle in the ways that we work with others who might come into our sphere of ministry. People like Hagar, who sometimes get used or abused in the name of the Lord. He wants us to remember that whether you're a married woman with no children or children, or whether you're a single mother, he will hear the cries of the children. He will try to recognize and he will answer and know each person individually, calling each of us by name, so that none of us are objectified, but all of us, if we can just ask him to give us the eyes of vision, can see and find his provision and know that he knows who each one of us are by name. So it was a tough life being the wife of Abram or being his concubine. It's a tough life sometimes nowadays. But we serve a God who sees us each individually. And just as Jesus prayed, you know, when Lazarus was raised from the dead, everyone stood there watching the same miracle in John chapter 11. And Jesus prayed a prayer to the Father in which he said, "Father, I pray that they will have the eyes to see and believe and to recognize your glory." The well was there. The provision was there for Hagar. She needed God to open her eyes to see his provision. Jesus raised Lazarus in front of many, many people. Not all of them understood the glory of God. Not all of them saw his provision there of life in the midst of death. But in every case, it was the well of the living one who sees me. He is the God who is alive, who brings us life, who knows us by name, and who wants us to experience his provision in a personal way. Thank you.